You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And we've got a sort of a picturesy theme today, a graphic novelist theme, really. My studio guest today is graphic novelist Woodrow Phoenix. We've also got interviews with Jade Sarson, fellow graphic novelist, and Glenn Dakin, who is a novelist but is here today. We'll be listening to him talking about writing Shaun the Sheep. Everybody loves Shaun the Sheep, don't we? That will be later in the show. But hello to you, Woodrow.
Hi there.
Good to have you on board. Now, it's a smaller world, isn't it? Because you've worked with both Glenn and Jade, who we're going to hear from on today's programme. Is it like that in the graphic novel world?
It is. It is a small world because there are only a few publishers, and everyone who tends to be interested in this kind of stuff will run across each other because of that. And because we all work in the same areas and we all do the kind of stuff. And there are conventions and things where we all meet up. So, yes, it's quite small.
Is it getting bigger?
It is getting bigger because I think as these areas of interest grow, then more people are coming in who have different kinds of things they want to talk about. So, yes, it is growing.
And is it fair to say the graphic novel is still a fledgling form? Obviously, we're going to be talking about this form in quite a lot of detail later. But would you still describe it as a fledgling form? It's still new to some people, isn't it?
You can think about it in lots of different kinds of ways. It's very new in one way, in that for a long time there haven't really been comics for adults in Britain. In France and in Japan, there have been comics for adults, you know, for the last 100 years. But Britain kind of gave up on that stuff in the 1930s, 1940s, and just kind of dropped the adult stuff and just went with comics for children. So we've got generations of people who just don't think that was a thing. They're kind of amazed to think that adults read these things. And it's not their fault, it's just there haven't been any comics for adults for a long time in Britain, so people are used to thinking of them as children's stuff.
I wonder why that is, why it carried on in some countries but not here.
I think it was a business decision. I think that comics are actually quite expensive to make compared to other forms because you have to print them in full colour or in black and white even, but still you have to deal with plates and pictures, and that's expensive. And it's really only in the last 15 years now that digital printing has come in. Printing's got much cheaper, so people can do graphic novels, you know, for relatively cheap prices compared to what they were like 10 years ago.
Well, good, because I do enjoy a graphic novel. Yeah. And we'll obviously be talking much more about that in just a moment. We're going to give you a proper introduction as well. But now, you've persuaded me to do something different. I usually get our guests to choose 3 pieces of music. You've chosen 10.
I have.
They are all relatively short. We're going to play them in chunks, 3 or 4 at a time. So this is a chunk of 3 coming up. So we've got tracks by Daft Punk, 18th Die and Bernard Herrmann. First of all, why have you chosen so many tracks? And why these particular ones?
Okay, well, it was torment to try and think of 3 or 4 for you, because one of the things that happens is, because I work in a studio and I'm drawing all day, I listen to music all day. So I listen to a lot of music, and my two co-workers and I, you know, we have the same kind of taste in music, so we're playing stuff all the time. So if you can imagine 8 hours a day playing lots of music, we get through a lot. So I have a lot of favourites, a lot of things I really like, and it's really, really hard to pick something. And I was thinking about, how am I going to do this? How am I going to whittle it down? And then I kind of realised one thing that I do a lot is often I'll fix on something and I'll play it just over and over and over and over, which is fine because the other guys do that too. But I thought, well, actually, there are lots of really short tracks that I play a lot. And I thought, if I just gave you a few of those, then you'd get a sense of what it'd be like to be in the studio for a whole day listening to all this stuff. Plus, it would be a good way to kind of get lots of different things across. Plus, I could talk about all the different things that I like. You know, which
excellent. So we have to imagine ourselves in a studio working side by side with
yeah,
you.
Yeah.
So why Daft Punk, 18th Die and Bernard Herrmann?
Because they're all things that I really love. They're all things I've played. I mean, all these 10 tracks are things I've played on repeat, like a lot of times. Just because something is short doesn't mean that it's not well thought out. Lots of musicians like the challenge of making something really crafted in a very small segment. But then lots of these things are like soundtracks where things get chopped up a lot. Anyway, yeah, so these three. The Daft Punk one was the soundtrack for, or part of the soundtrack for Tron, the second Tron. And it was kind of a boring film, but it was amazing to listen to that soundtrack. And it's really dramatic. It makes you feel like, I must go out and fight crime right now, yes! So I like that a lot. And so, yeah, I play that a lot. 18th Die, a band from Berlin. I really love them because of that dynamic thing of loud and soft, like Pixies and like Nirvana and lots of bands like that that I also really like. And Bernard Herrmann, as they call him in the States, Bernard, is just one of the greatest composers of all time, and I listen to his work a lot. It's very atmospheric and very moody, and this one is just a really, again, very dramatic and really interesting, and gets you kind of really hyped up for what's coming next.
Well, we're running them all together, so let's see how that Daft Punk 18th Die Bernard Herrmann mix sounds. Well, that was Daft Punk 18th Die and Bernard Herrmann. They're the first three choices for music today of our studio guest on Bookmark, Woodrow Phoenix. Woodrow is a British comics artist, writer, editorial illustrator, graphic designer and author of children's books. Among his solo creations are The Sumo Family and The Liberty Cats, the former being serialised in The Independent on Sunday. In 2011, he edited Nelson, a groundbreaking collective graphic novel in which 54 creators each produced chapters of a single continuing story. The Times awarded it Best Graphic Novel of 2011, and it was voted Book of the Year in the British Comic Awards. But he's best known for Rumblestrip, which explores our dependence on cars. Ali Smith said of it, "Every so often a book like this comes along which allows fresh vision, even a change of mindset. Brilliant. A crucial revelation." And the London Times said it was an utterly original work of genius. Well, I suppose the obvious question, I mean, that was the edited highlights of your very impressive CV, Woodrow. But I suppose the obvious question coming out of that is the graphic novel. Why that form for you?
It's one of those things, I didn't really choose it. It chose me, you know. I sometimes think about being a graphic novelist as being like the best 12th century lyric poet around, in that, you know, it's a form that some people are going to really love and some people are just not going to care about no matter what you do, you know, so there's an inherent limitation there, but that's kind of okay. You know, I love pictures and I love words and I love what happens when you put them together in this way, and I really like what happens when you are exploring narrative with pictures over time.
And bearing in mind that for some people it is a fledgling form, as we were saying earlier, I suppose we should define what a graphic novel is and how it's different to a comic and a picture book. How would you describe a graphic? How would you differentiate it?
Yeah, it's one of those things. If you get 10 comics artists in a room, then five of them will disagree with you about the term. It's one of those, it's very contested because it harks back to all kinds of things and it also isn't its own thing. What is a graphic novel? It sounds like a novel with pictures. Well, and so it is just a long-form comic strip.
And a lot of people have come to being graphic novelists through writing comics. That seems to be a familiar route.
Yeah, because all it is, it's just taking what's used for short things and making it into something long and sustained. So rather than having a piece that's only 10 pages long, you can make a piece that's 200 pages long.
And were you always into comics as a child? Was
always,
that a big thing for you?
Yeah, I grew up reading them, starting with things on the newspapers and, you know, Peanuts and Fred Bassett and all that kind of stuff.
And did you start writing? You started writing comics, but presumably at some stage, writing comics became the urge to write a graphic novel. Can you remember at what point that was?
I was doing lots of short things with various people, including Glenn Dakin, who you'll be hearing from later. But it was because I was working in Los Angeles. I was working on a cartoon based on one of my comics for Cartoon Network. And Los Angeles is unlike London in that it's very, very spread out. and there's no public transport to speak of. I mean, there are buses and there are trains, but they're functionally useless. And I thought I was going to live next to the studio, didn't need a car, because that's what I thought would be like London. But it turns out that in Los Angeles, you can't live without a car, because everything requires you to drive. So even though the studio was only four blocks from where I was staying, everything else was miles away. And I tried taking a bus for the first week or two, and it was impossible because it took way too long, and so I had to get a car. And I really liked driving a lot. I inherited that from my dad, who was a very, very keen driver. He changed his car every couple of years. He used to go anywhere, any excuse to drive. And so I got that from him. I really like it. But what I found was that having to drive all the time is very isolating, because it's just you in your car doing things. If you arrange to meet your friends, you all drive separately to a place. Then when it's over, you all drive separately away again. And there's no kind of serendipity. There's no kind of bumping into people. You're just always you alone. And it's really isolating and it's really weird. And I began to think about that a lot and what that was like and what that meant for us, you know, as a society. And I thought it explained a lot about why people in Los Angeles are the way they are. Slightly weird, because they're all in their cars by themselves all the time. So I thought I should write about this. This is weird, and this is kind of interesting, and I think it's going this way around the world anyway. So that was what the genesis was for writing about Rumblestrip. And then I started thinking about all the other things that bother me about cars and driving, even though I like them. Like the way that... It was one of the things, my dad always said this thing, you know, if you want to kill somebody, you know, run them over and you'll get away with it.
Yes, and you start the book almost with that line. But why did that become a novel and not a comic strip? Because it was an idea rather... Because there are no characters in it. It is ideas. Was that what made it?
It's because there's a lot of ideas to unpick in it. There's a lot of stuff to talk about. And the best way to do that was to do it visually. Because driving is all about looking, it's all about seeing, it's all about signs and graphics and the environment and other drivers, and so comics can do that really, really well. And I wanted to have the interior voice discussing what was going on, pointing you at things, showing you things, talking about them. So that was the ideal form to put it in.
And have you always been a person who thinks like that, who thinks visually?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, I do like writing, and I have written lots of prose only things, but it's about, you know, what fits the content, really. Some things want to be graphic novels, some things want to be just words.
Well, there's a lot of variety in your work, definitely, and a variation in style. How do you decide on the style?
It's what fits with the idea, whatever it is. I mean, I think it's amazing how you can totally change how something feels by changing how it looks. The same idea expressed in watercolour or in charcoal or in ink or in paint will feel very different because of those different media. So it's all about finding the right one to express it with. Which one's going to work best for this idea?
And do you find that medium first before the words come, or do the words come before, or does it happen at the same time?
It's kind of the same thing. To me, it's not about words and images, it's about the idea. And so how do you express the idea? Some bits of it are expressed visually, and some bits of it are expressed verbally. So you put the two things together like that.
Well, we're going to talk to you more about Rumblestrip, but talking about pictures and words, and a colleague of yours, Jade Sarson, we'll hear from her now. Since graduating from Lincoln University in 2011 with a degree in illustration, Jade Sarson has devoted herself to the medium. She self-published a comic series, Café Suada, and in 2013 was nominated for Best Emerging Talent in the British Comic Awards. A year later, she won the Myriad Edition's first graphic novel competition with For the Love of God, Marie, about a young Catholic girl's awakening. It received glowing reviews, many of which commented on the energy of the illustrations. So when I spoke to Jade on the phone, I asked her how she managed to convey such energy in her art.
Oh, it's very much about kind of speedy drawing. I'm very much a risk taker, and luckily because I work digitally, it means that I can try lots of different strokes. Luckily, I have the undo button, which is a magical tool.
So you work digitally?
Yeah, I do. I work on a graphics tablet.
Because I did wonder, because there are so many illustrations in the book, I thought it must have taken you years and years.
Oh, God, it nearly did. No, it took... Originally, we'd set about a year in which to do it, but planning script and everything took quite a lot longer than I'd estimated for. the actual drawing ended up running to more like 2 years.
And how do you plan something like a graphic novel?
I think it really depends on who's writing and illustrating it. You know, if you have a writer and illustrator team, then obviously the script usually comes first and then the illustrator will interpret it. Some illustrators I know tend to prefer to just come up with the images first and then match dialogue to it. But me personally, I definitely prefer a combination of writing out dialogue as I kind of imagine it in my head and then working up the imagery from that. But it's more of like a loose script rather than, you know, the more formal like script for TV and such.
And it's quite a raunchy book, Jade. It is about sex and morality. It's quite raunchy. Does the graphic novel form suit those kind of issues, do you think?
I definitely think so. I mean, I've been inspired by quite a few other raunchy graphic novels that I've read myself, and I just found that they were so much more fun to read. You can read, you know, raunchy novels or watch raunchy TV shows, and it just doesn't quite have that same spirit or fun to it. When you watch, you know, a raunchy sex scene on TV, it feels quite robotic, and you can tell the actors quite often aren't comfortable with each other. But when you're writing and drawing fictional characters, you can, you know, create that chemistry. You know, you can rework the expressions in every scene to make sure that you're really feeling the kind of, well, the way that they're feeling in the raunchy scenes.
Are there things that you think are particularly difficult to cover in a graphic novel?
I think it can be really difficult to sort of convey what each character is thinking without being really obvious and using like narrative boxes and narration. It can be a bit harder to be a bit more subtle with showing what's going on in a character's head during a scene. Quite often people will just resort to narrative boxes, but I quite like to push my character's expressions and really hope that the reader will interpret them the way I want them to.
And graphic novels are very easy to read. They're very quick to read. Quite often people read them at one sitting. Are you aware of that when you're putting it together?
I am. It's kind of painful. Like when you mentioned the reviews on the back of the book, when I first sent the book to a couple of my trusted friends to review it, they got back to me within one night. They were like, I read it all last night. Whoa, it's so good. And I was like, it took me 2 years to make this. And you read it in one night. Got to do the maths on that. How long does that mean you spent on each page?
And does it affect how you put it together if you're aware that people are reading it, not necessarily at speed, but they're reading the beginning of the story on the same reading slot as they're reading the end?
Yeah, I think it definitely affects both how I sort of arrange the imagery on the page and also how much detail I put in. When I started out as an illustrator, I was doing a lot of really heavy detail work, especially on sort of character designs. But when you're working in comics and graphic novels, you really can't afford to put as much detail in as you would on a really detailed illustration, because people just aren't going to spend the amount of time looking at it as you would like. You have to treat it differently. With the layout, because people are reading at speed, you really have to put a lot of thought into the actual pacing of the panels on the page. If you really want the readers to spend a lot of time looking at a scene, you have to add a lot of space between that scene and the next to make sure that their eye doesn't just glance over it too quickly.
What other things influence a decision about, say, the size of an illustration or a box, or where it goes on the page, or the level of detail?
I think very much about impact. Like, you may have noticed when you were reading the book, there are a few full-page illustrations, so there's just one panel on a page, say, where a character reveals something about themselves or a new character shows up. And it's very much about, you know, impact. So with those splash pages, you're really wanting the reader to be amazed or shocked and actually pause for a second, just take it in. And the same goes for really tiny panels where you're having, like, lots of funny beats in the story. Those kind of panels where they're smaller mean that the reader will jump over them quickly, so they're actually getting the jokes at the right pace.
And I suppose you're conscious about what the reader is thinking in between the panels, what you're not saying.
Definitely. It was really hard writing it, because when I was speaking to my editor about it, she was saying, you know, you're being too literal about this, or maybe a bit too preachy in places. And it's like, I don't want to preach to the reader, but at the same time, I don't want them to get the wrong idea about the characters as well. So it's really important to strike that right balance of not telling them everything. I guess it's that important cinema rule of showing, not telling.
You have to make a decision about what you're going to reveal to the reader and what you're going to let the reader imagine for themselves.
Definitely. And I think it's funny because when I was at the launch for the book, some people had read, you know, advanced copies, and they were telling me their theories for what could happen afterwards or what had happened in those gaps between scenes. And it was really funny how often they kind of matched what I had thought in my head, because even though there are a lot of scenes that are missing from the story that you don't get to see, I still have to imagine what is happening in between so that the story works and flows properly. It's really good to hear when people kind of go, oh, I figured this happened, and I'm going, yeah, you got it right.
And what I also liked is that it allows you to address the reader directly. We hear your voice, the narrator's voice. The author. We even see you at one stage. You draw yourself.
Yeah. It was a little bit of a selfish scene there, but I felt it worked.
Now, it won the first graphic novel competition. What was that like?
Oh, that was very exciting. When I was studying to be an illustrator, one of the really important things that they drove into us as students was to enter lots of competitions. And it's kind of a catch-22 because you want to be doing more work, you know, paid work as an illustrator, but competitions obviously don't pay. So it gets really hard to kind of keep up the motivation to keep entering. And I'd entered quite a few illustration competitions over the years and comics competitions as well, and I'd lost so many. And, you know, I kept saying to myself, well, it's a learning experience. It's really important to keep doing it and keep trying. So when it got to the awards night and there were all these other talented illustrators there, I was just kind of shocked because I was like, oh, I'm in this lineup with these other fantastic creators. And I was just happy to kind of show my work to them and to the audience there. But what was quite funny was we were reading our extract to the audience there, and I was taking a bit too long. So I got told to hurry up, and I was like, oh no, my one shot at, you know, showing people before I get cast back into the darkness. But luckily, even though they'd rushed me, they kind of went, it's fine, because you won, you know, you get to show everyone anyway.
How do you read extracts from a graphic novel?
That's a good question. When they asked me to do it, I was like, what? How do I do that? I did half reading out the dialogue and half explaining what was going on the page. But I think far better way of doing it was the way Jessica Martin, one of the other nominees for the award, she's an actress as well, so she fully acted out the scenes from her comic. She, you know, did different voices for each of the characters, and I was just like, oh, she's one up me there. That was fantastic.
Next time, Jo. Well, congratulations. It's a brilliant achievement and a very, very enjoyable novel. So what's next for you?
Lots of people have asked if I'd make a sequel. I'd really like a rest first. Yeah, I definitely am entertaining the thought of doing more comics about the characters, especially Will, because everyone seems to be a huge fan of him. But aside from Marie, I've got another comic that I'm working on called Café Suada, and it's a tea-stained webcomic series. And I'm mainly focusing on kind of getting that back on track, because I had to put it on hiatus while I was working on For the Love of God, Marie. And that was kind of heartbreaking because it's like my baby. So I want to finish it.
That's Jade Sarson there talking about her graphic novel, For the Love of God, Marie. And you can support Jade's work, if you so wish, through patreon.com. You can find her on there. That's patreon.com. My studio guest on Bookmark today is fellow graphic novelist Woodrow Phoenix. I was quite relieved there, Woodrow, in a way, when Jade said she worked digitally, because there's lots of pictures in her book and I sort of imagined her beavering away from dawn till dusk. Do you work digitally too?
Yes and no. I do everything on paper first, then I scan it, and then I will adjust it on the computer. I don't like working digitally from start to finish because I really enjoy the physical thing of using paper and pencils and ink and brushes. I like the way it smells. I like the way it sounds when I'm scritching on the paper. I like everything about it. And computers are great because you can refine something and make it really finished. But it doesn't feel the same to me anyway. So I would rather work analog than I do.
And let's talk about the images for Rumble Strip, because there are no characters in Rumble Strip. It is shots of roads and signs and things related to roads. Why did you decide on that format?
I was thinking about the problem of all kinds of narrative fiction, which is that you have to have a protagonist to enjoy the story through. And if you don't identify with that person, then you're not going to really get into the story. And that's a problem for all kinds of fiction, because obviously no one person is going to represent everyone. And I was thinking about a way to make it feel like I was talking to you directly. And I had tried this technique on a short story before, and it occurred to me that it's a really good way to make someone feel like they are directly involved. If there are no people around, if there are just pictures and the captions take the place of people, then it just feels much more immersive. And what happens is that without even really thinking about it, you start reading the captions. The captions are telling you about what you're looking at, and you just place yourself there. So it becomes a very good way of making you inhabit the things you're looking at. And it turns out that it works so well that it's a way to kind of short circuit what people do when they look at comics, which is to idealize what they're looking at. This way, it makes it much more internal. So yeah, it's a very effective way to just put all that information across.
And because it's a book about cars and our dependence on cars, and it's, we feel like we're driving through the book,
yeah,
I suppose.
That's how you should feel. Yeah.
But presumably, even then, you're looking at pacing. So the scale and the size and the image has to reflect the dialogue, well, the words.
Yes. So the way that it's all arranged is very carefully thought out to make you feel, or to hopefully make you feel as if what's happening in the captions is reflected in what's happening in the pictures, and you will then understand what it's saying through those two things put together.
Right, well, there's lots of questions about Rumble Strip, and we will come back to that. We've got four more tracks now from your choice. We've got Yukari Fresh, Mr. Oizo?
Wazo,
let's go for that. Wazo, Glenn Branca and Robert Ashley. So talk us through these four. Again, we're going to play them back to back, see how they mix up. But yes, talk us through them.
Okay, well, Yukari Fresh is a Japanese pop artist, part of the Shibuya K kind of set from the late 90s. And I really love this kind of stuff because it's very joyous and it's very inventive. And they play around a lot with just the sonic capabilities of sampling.
Mr. Oizo. I'm determined to
everyone
call him
knows who he is because he did Flat Beat with Flat Eric, which you would know if you heard it because it's the one with the yellow glove puppet that was used to advertise Levi's. And he's a really great dance music person because he has this way of making tracks that are kind of sarcastic but celebratory at the same time. It's like he loves everything about dance music, but he knows how corny it is, so he does things to make it new again, and I really love what he does. He's also got really great melodies, really great tunes. They're very hooky.
And then you've got Glenn Branca.
Glenn Branca is a modern composer who uses guitars a lot and a wall of sound. His stuff is very, very noisy and very, very abstract and dissonant and very, very big. And he collaborates on the soundtrack for Belly of an Architect, filmed by
Peter Greenaway.
And I really love what he did for it. He used violins the same way that he kind of tends to use guitars, as this kind of just wall of sound that kind of grows. And it's really, really contemplative and makes you feel like you're listening to something eternal.
It's a lovely piece. And finally, the last track, Robert Ashley, this is an odd one, The Airline Ticket Counter.
Robert Ashley, 20th century composer, he died last year. I think he was truly original and truly amazing at making what he called them operas. Most people wouldn't think of them as operas because they are just people talking and singing. But it's all about using different systems for making music, different kinds of sounds, using the human voice and using accents and using local things and using colour and turning it all into something which is very profound.
Well, let's start with that Yukari Fresh track.
Thank you.
be angry and jealous. How is
it? You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105, where our studio guest today is graphic novelist Woodrow Phoenix. We were talking just before the music there, Woodrow, about Rumble Strip, your book about our dependence on the car. And you talked a little bit beforehand about how when you lived in Los Angeles, you realised that and how isolating it was. You also, in the book, you recount some personal experiences. Are they genuine, things that happened to your family?
Yeah, everything. Yeah, the book isn't fiction, it's all real. Everything in it happened to somebody or was recorded by somebody. It's all real stuff. I did lots of research. I spoke to lots of people. I read lots of databases. I looked at all kinds of stats and things. And then I combined all of that to arrive at what we get in the book, which kind of, it's like a picture of what's happening around the world. About the way that we have evolved, the way that roads both make things easier for us and make things much more difficult for us as a society, and about just what that means, really, about how we behave on them, and about the weird psychology of them.
And the experiences that you can't recount, I mean, these are life-changing experiences, people that you have lost because of road accidents.
Mm,
mm. I mean, you wanted to share those in the book.
I wanted to talk a bit about the psychology of it, because, like we say, if people die in any other way, then it's a problem, it's a disaster, it's something terrible. But because cars are so important, we have managed to arrive at this situation where if someone dies in a car crash, then it's just one of those things that happens. It's not really a big deal. Just, yeah, get over it. These things happen. And we wouldn't allow that in any other sphere of life. And the fact that so many people die in cars every year, you know, a million people, that's a crazy amount of people to die. And it sounds unbelievable, you know, when you tell people that, that's, I don't believe that. But really, that's, it gets more. It gets bigger than that.
Well, your opening image is of this dangling piano. And imagine that if the world was full of dangling pianos, how would we feel walking under them, and we would be at risk all the time?
Well, it was important to try and find a metaphor to make people just think about what it was that we do. Because we do this every day, and we have done it every day all our lives, we have completely trained ourselves not to think about what it really means to have tons of metal flying around at insane speeds, and the fact that we are just flesh and blood and we can all be killed very easily. And, you know, every day people are going to go out and they're not going to go home again because they're going to get killed. And it seems kind of strange that we should be so casual about this. And it's partly because we have no real way anymore of just accepting the psychological enormity of what it is that we do every day.
Yeah, that's our cause. Well, there's no easy shift from that to Shaun the Sheep, but we'll do our best. Glenn Dakin is the author of the Candleman book series. While working for Marvel UK, he wrote the comics Clandestine and The Real Ghostbusters, among other. He also co-edited, wrote and drew Sinister Romance with one Woodrow Phoenix. Whatever happened to him, I don't know. He's worked on the Angry Birds movie and a number of animated series for children's TV, including Shaun the Sheep.
Gotta meet this fella living down on the farm, because he's pretty cool and mellow, he's the king of the barn. When there's mayhem in the meadow, he keeps his crew on track for all his legendary adventures. They should put up a plaque for Shaun the Sheep. He's Shaun the Sheep. He even mucks about with those who cannot bleat.
I think it's just something that everybody can get. You know, it's the setup of, with the sheep on the farm, and it's also the setup of a individual in a world of conformity, if you know what I mean, not wanting to be too deep about it. But, you know, Shaun is the one who thinks differently. He's the one who makes things happen. And because of that, he often gets into trouble and he has to put it right. You know, that's a common thing with Shaun, is he'll do something thinking this will be great, you know, and then it all goes horribly wrong and then he has to try and put it right. And I think a lot of people feel like that. And I think a lot of children feel like that, you know, that you... The one time you try to do something different, you think this is going to be amazing, and you know, you end up having to say sorry or having to clear up or whatever. So I think there's a lot of universality to it. You know, it's a lot of the best TV shows are like that, aren't they? You can relate to them. The sheep situation creates a kind of amusing, quirky uniqueness to it. You know, there are certain things, like I did an episode once called Sheep Walking, which took something from the idea that sheep always are supposed to always follow each other, aren't they? So I did one episode in which Sean was sleepwalking and doing all these amazing things in his sleep, but all the other sheep thought they had to do it as well. So you had this whole flock of sheep going along a telegraph wire in the middle of the night and creeping through a campsite, you know, doing extraordinary stunts just because Sean was doing them, but he was completely unaware of the fact that he was doing them. So that was a sort of sheep-like characteristic. But a lot of the storylines could be applied to many human situations where somebody is trying to be clever and or different. Shaun the Sheep was the only TV series I've ever worked on where I had like a job interview, because normally it doesn't really work like that. But they actually asked writers to come down to Aardman to be spoken to see if they would kind of get the idea of Shaun the Sheep. You know, we wanted it to be something everyone could like, a bit like Laurel and Hardy, that anyone could watch it, or Charlie Chaplin, you know, anyone could watch it of any culture. So it started off with quite a complicated process where we would have meetings where all the writers would sit around the table. We would all pitch our ideas. And then if you had an idea and somebody could see a slight problem with it, what we call snagging, you know, someone would say, well, yeah, in your story, Shaun the Sheep grows to giant size. How are we going to shrink him back to normal at the end? So you'd have to, we'd all thrash it out together. And then you'd go away and write your version of the story. And then the script editor would go through it and say, too long, not funny enough, or whatever, you know. Then you'd have to, you often do three drafts of the story. As time's gone by on Shaun the Sheep, we don't have so many of those big writers' meetings. In fact, on the most recent series 5, it was great because I went down to Aardman and I was just working with the script editor and with the kind of creative producer, Steve Box, who he's written movies like Chicken Run and Flushed Away. You know, he's one of the main sort of creative people there. Just the three of you sit in the room and you talk about the ideas and you bounce them around. And when you've got a kind of beginning, middle and end, then you get sent home to write it up. So it's like going home to do your homework. And then you have to remember what works for you about the episode. And that's where you get to really take control of it and put your own spin on it. So it's quite a team process. There was a time about halfway through, like series 2 and 3, where you could write a whole story and send it in, and then they would make that story, and then that would be really your episode. But because we've done so many episodes of Shaun now, there's a danger that you're going to put in jokes that have been done before. So it has to be quite carefully looked at by Aardman, and so that's why it's a little bit more collaborative now.
Perhaps one day you'll find a way to come and meet with Shaun the Sheep.
You know, sometimes you just get a word like hedgehog and you have to make a story out of that because we haven't had a hedgehog. You know, like I did a couple like that. There was one called The Genie. And in fact, it was a girl who was a big fan of Shaun the Sheep had sent in a sheet of about 60 ideas for Shaun the Sheep. And they gave us a couple of them and they gave that one to me. So the idea wasn't mine, but I had to invent everything that happened in the story. An episode of Shaun has lots of little things that happen one after another. So they sort of say, use 6 beats to set it up. So you would say, you know, we open on the farm, zoom in on Shaun. He is munching happily. Then, you know, then the third beat will be suddenly Shaun hears something. He turns around, you know, so you describe every individual action and the sound effects. And you have to remember that everything that you write has to be built because it's all physical models. So you can't write anything that can't be built or anything that would be too expensive to be built. So you have to think about the budget at the same time. But basically you describe a series of actions and it has to be very evident from everything that happens how everyone is feeling about that. So you have a lot of reaction shots. So if Shaun falls over, cut to Timmy, the other sheep, looking shocked, cut back to Shaun. So you have lots of reaction shots built into the show so everybody knows what to feel while they're watching it. Because sometimes if you took away those things, some of the slapstick, you might just feel sorry for Shaun if he fell over. But if you show him falling over and then you show the pigs looking over the fence laughing at him, then you know you're supposed to find it funny. So it's built like that.
He even mucks about with those who cannot fleet. Keep it in mind.
You write something and you don't really know until it comes back from, you know, from the studio. how it's going to come out. But with Aardman, it's always so well done. I mean, the storyboard artists put in some visual ideas as well, and the producers do. And sometimes you might write something, didn't quite work on screen, so they have to find another way of doing it. It reminds me a bit of, you know, for the digital age of cameras, you know, when you used to take a load of photographs on holiday and you wouldn't have any idea what they were going to look like until the film came back from the chemist. It's a lovely moment when you finally see the episode and you think, oh, that's what they did.
He's shown the sheep. He's shown the sheep. He's not afraid to make.
Basically, whatever happens to Sean, he can't really think to himself, well, I'm never going to do that again, because he has to remain a curious, upbeat, brainy little sheep. He has to remain the same character so he can go through all the silly adventures all over again. There's a little bit of a message of getting on, you know, with people who are different to you, but it would spoil it in a way if Sean, for example, made friends with the pigs and then they never teased each other again. So because there are animals, there's a sense in which they'll always be true to their nature. You know, they've got a bull on the farm. The bull will always be a bit of a worry. You know, he might do something angry. The dog, Bitzer, he'll always be a bit of a Jobsworth. Do you know what I mean? The farmer will always be a bit dim. He'll never quite cotton on to what's going on. There aren't any really preachy sides to Sean. We're not trying to, you know, give them any philosophical guidance. I do find sometimes if you mention you write Sean, people just, that's the one thing they want to talk about, and they're not interested in if you've written a book or a comic or whatever. It's a lovely thing to do, and it's nice that people, you know, enthusiastic. I mean, there are lots of shows, TV shows, people kind of get tired of them after a while. But I think they've been careful with Sean. They haven't overdone it. They've kept up a good quality for a certain amount of episodes. They've done a good movie. They haven't, you know, they haven't put in guest stars and things like when TV shows start to go wrong. I mean, I was very pleased with an episode called Stick With Me, which was one of the ones that helped Aardman win their first ever Emmy, which was Best International Children's Show. And Aardman, up to that point, hadn't won prize for that. It was one of four episodes that were sent to the judges, and it was based around a simple thing. I was actually, when they said Shaun the Sheep should be a bit like Laurel and Hardy, I watched a couple of old Laurel and Hardys, and there was one scene, just a tiny moment, where they were working as carpenters and one of them had put his hand on a tube of glue and then tried to shake it off, and he was stuck. And it was just a very small moment in the episode, and I thought, that's a great little visual idea. So I expanded a whole idea from that to do with the sheep getting caught together with glue, and it ended up getting worse and worse, you know, all the sheep end up in like a huge ball of sheep, which is rolling through the farm, and the dog Bitzer is like Indiana Jones running away with this ball advancing on him. I was very pleased with that one. I'm working on a new story at the moment, a new children's novel. I had a couple of children's books out a few years ago in a series of Candleman, about a modern day boy who's descended from a Victorian superhero. And I wanted to do something in a similar vein, a bit creepy, a bit funny. So it's a sort of a magical, mysterious adventure set in the modern day, but connected to the past. So this is for a slightly younger, it's a slightly funnier book. And I'm also writing lots of articles about Marvel comics at the moment for a publication called The Marvel Fact Files. And we're having a lot of fun on that because I grew up on Marvel comics, and I'm getting to write a lot of things about my heroes, people like Stan Lee, who invented Spider-Man and the whole Marvel universe, and some of the great early artists who worked for Marvel comics, like Jack Kirby, who visualized everybody, you know, from the Hulk, Iron Man, Thor, Captain America, the X-Men, you know, all the great characters that are now in the blockbuster movies. They were all basically designed and originated visually by Jack Kirby. So I'm writing articles about my heroes, and that's a nice job to have in writing.
That's Glenn Dakin there talking about Shaun the Sheep. I do apologise because you're going to be singing that Shaun the Sheep song all day now. Glenn there talking about his heroes, Woodrow Phoenix. Who's your hero? Who's your... do you have a comic book hero?
Oh, there are too many to even start. I would just be here all day talking about people who inspire me for different things. Right now, I'm very, very enamoured of a couple of French artists whose work I like a lot, who are just managing to do just surprising and interesting things with it. But yeah, there are lots of people. I think originally, when I first started reading comics, I was just attracted to the way that you could just warp reality completely with a change from one frame to the next. And then I became very interested in how you could do that. I'm trying to think of who would be the person that I would, whose work I would take to a desert island right now.
I'll have a few moments. Oh, sadly, we've actually come to the end of our time. I'm going to come back to you to talk about your last choices of music, but we've come to the end of our time with you. But thank you ever so much. Just quickly, what are you working on at the moment?
I'm working on two things. One's a book about making comics, about how they work, all the things that you have to do to make an interesting book, which would make it not like a film and not like a novel, things that are intrinsically about comics themselves. And the other one's a kind of biography.
Oh, keep us guessing. next show, my studio guest will be Nicola Streeton. Do you know Nicola?
I do.
You, of course you do. She's the author of the graphic memoir Billy, Me and You about the loss of her two-year-old son. And she's also co-founder of Ladies Do Comics. We'll also be hearing from Midge Gillies about her new book Army Wives, The Women Behind the Men Who Went to War. And Caroline Shenton will be talking about her book Mr. Barry's War about the rebuilding of the Houses of Parliament. But we're going to sign out now with your last three choices of music, Woodrow. This is Public Enemy, Mogwai and Broadcast tracks from all three of those. Why these three?
Well, Public Enemy because I listened to a lot of hip-hop and you said no swearing, so that immediately knocked out like two-thirds of all the things I listened to. But this doesn't have any in it. So Broadcast because I think they're a really interesting, again, really great group. And Trish Keenan died very sadly a couple of years ago, and it's very hard to hear this track without thinking about those things.
Mogwai.
Mogwai, because that loud, quiet thing, again, they are amazingly dynamic and very interesting the way they combine those things to make songs that are very, very heartfelt and very emotional, but also very strangely rocky and powerful.
Yo, Chuck, these honey drippers are still fronting on us. Show them that we can do this, because we always knew this. Yeah, boy!
Bass, how low can you go? Death row? What a brother know. Once again, back is the incredible rhyme animal, the uncannibal D. Public Enemy number one. 5-volt set freeze. And I got numb. Can I tell them that I really never had a gun? But it's the wax that the Terminator X.